listening to a very special edition of Spitfire Woman of Color Radio as part of the Homelessness Marathon, a national broadcast running until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. We are here outside in Montreal at the Native Friendship Center, literally holding it down in the street in the cold, and it snowed this week, so, you know, it's really cold. And I'm here with all of our lovely ladies, Malek, Mercedes, Victoria, Gao. My name's Alyssa.
You can call in toll-free all night at 866-594-7729 or come visit us with hot chocolate. Please do.
Please.
Show your solidarity with the homeless. Also, happy Black History Month to our listeners in Montreal and beyond. We've got a great program in store for you tonight. We will be tackling issues of homelessness with some hard-hitting reports. We will also be celebrating Black History Month throughout our show.
Malek will bring you an interview with Bridget Tolley, founder of Families of Sisters in Spirit, an emerging grassroots volunteer organization led by families of missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls. While Gao turns a critical eye on the recent push from the Ville-Marie Borough to, quote-unquote, revitalize Cabot Square, which would lead to the displacement of marginalized people that currently use the space as a meeting place and a place to chill, you know, relax in the park.
Mercedes right over here. How you doing, Mercedes? Yeah. Mercedes is going to discuss a recent crisis brought to light by American media sources ProPublica and Color Lines that reveals a disturbing number of PTSD cases found in lower-class neighborhoods, such as those with a high concentration of African Americans in Detroit, Atlanta, Chicago, and Philly.
In honor of Black History Month and the historical connections between Black and Indigenous collective resistance, Alyssa brings you some history on Black Indigenous connections through the voice of Clinton, a Black Indian depicted in Leslie Shilko's novel, Almanac of the Dead. She'll read an excerpt from the novel.
All that and more coming up right now on Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Check it out.
So we're going to go to some music now and then come back for some headlines.
See you in a bit.
Music.
The musical therapy of the sounds
should
of the
street. Should we just start singing?
It's all good. Maybe we should just...
Organized. And he's on...
Oh. Whoa.
That sounded good, girl. That sounded good.
Chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could
We are broadcasting in a very special edition of Spitfire as part of the Homelessness Marathon, which is broadcasting throughout CKUT nationally until tomorrow morning. You can call in toll-free all night at 866-594-7729. Right now, we are going to go to some headlines.
For today's headlines, I wanted to draw our attention to different kinds of homelessness, one being the kind of homelessness that migrants experience in their cross-continental journeys, often escaping targeted violence in their countries of origin, for estrangement, abuse, and further alienation in countries that have little compassion for those just trying to provide for their families. February marks the five-month anniversary of the historic migrant strike in Lindsay, Ontario, against endless detentions and maximum security incarceration. Striking migrants have faced reprisals, with many deported, locked up in segregation, moved to other prisons, and denied access to legal counsel. Since 2004, there have been tens of thousands of migrant detentions per year in Canada. Canada is one of the only, quote-unquote, Western countries to indefinitely detain people. This means that some immigration detainees have been unjustly locked away without charge for nearly 10 years. February 28th also marks the two-month anniversary of the death of Lucia Vega Jimenez's. While under CBSA custody, this was in December in Vancouver, or in B.C., Sia was a 42-year-old Mexican migrant who worked in Vancouver as a hotel worker. She was arrested on December 1st for an unpaid bus ticket and then transferred to immigration authorities who incarcerated her at a provincial prison pending deportation. On December 20th, she hung herself in the bathroom of a Vancouver airport detention center and 8 days later died in hospital while still under CBSA custody. CBSA kept her death a secret, and to date, neither a full coroner's inquest nor an independent investigation has been ordered. Migrants across the country are finding themselves in situations of tremendous precarity, sometimes resorting to death rather than facing detention and deportation. For people in Toronto, this Friday, February 28th, show your support at the Migrant Dignity, Not Migrant Death, End Immigration Detention Rally. Get the details by visiting endimmigration.com or just Google the wonderful organization No One Is Illegal to find more information. For people in Montreal, you can show your solidarity with Mrs. Awan and other sanctuary struggles. For on February 27th, it will have been 6 months that Khurshid Begum Awan took sanctuary in a Montreal church. In August 2013, she made the courageous decision to defy a removal order, which would have seen her return to Pakistan, where she faces targeted violence, lack of access to appropriate medical care, and indefinite separation from her daughter and grandson, who live in Montreal. On Thursday, February 27, 2013, the Awan Family Support Committee invites community members to a noon-hour protest in front of Citizenship and Immigration and CBSA offices. So show your support with the Awan family and with the families who are living in sanctuary across Canada. So again, that's tomorrow for us Montrealers, Thursday, February 27th. 12 to 1 outside the CIC and CBSA offices. That's 1010 St. Antoine Metro Bonaventure. Lastly, I just wanted to bring our attention to a small victory for upholding the constitutional rights of the homeless in New York City this week, our favorite sister city to the south here. New York City has backed off of a plan to remove homeless people from subway stations following a public campaign against the planned sweep. Advocates for the homeless there were on patrol early Monday morning to ensure that people could remain in the subways where they are staying warm, right? Because it's cold out. Participants at a rally on Sunday said homeless people should not be forced to choose between shelters and jail. One homeless New Yorker really brings the issue of homelessness down to earth. Daniel Sanchez states on Democracy Now! This week, I graduated from a Stuyvesant High School, which is known as one of the greatest high schools in the city, and 6 months later, I was sleeping on the MTA trains. So I want to be clear to those of you who might be watching this and feeling this, that this isn't an issue that's connected to you. I never thought that I was going to end up homeless. So most New Yorkers are only one paycheck away from homelessness. So understand that at any given time, a couple of bad breaks and you could be in the same situation. So that's me, Victoria, signing off from Spitfire, passing the mic to Mercedes.
Who isn't Thank wearing you. Any gloves right now, everyone who's listening. No gloves.
It's cold. It's just a lot easier. So, as mentioned by Malek at the beginning of the show, I will be discussing a recent crisis brought to light by American news sources, ProPublica and Color Lines, about the disturbing number of post-traumatic stress disorder cases, that's PTSD, found in lower-class neighborhoods, such as those with a high concentration of African Americans, in Detroit, Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia. When we hear these four letters, we are more likely to associate it to individuals who have endured psychological trauma because of their exposure to war, whether they are in the military or civilian. But PTSD is defined as a psychologically traumatic event involving actual or threatened death or serious injury to oneself or others. Such triggering events are called stressors. They may be experienced alone or while in a large group. Violent personal assaults such as rape or mugging, car or plane accidents, military combat, industrial accidents, and natural disasters are stressors which have caused people to suffer from PTSD. In some cases, seeing another person harmed or killed, or learning that a close friend or family member is in serious danger, has caused the development of PTSD symptoms. Therefore, PTSD encompasses more triggering experiences than meets the eye. But that is not the focus of what I want to bring forward through my report. What I want to shed light on is the fact that there are individuals who are fighting their own battles outside of the war zone. It is not in the same context as soldiers who fight in a war, but it's just as life-changing. As I mentioned earlier on, I want to shed light on the growing number of PTSD cases found among impoverished populations that are predominantly people of color. The reason the number of cases is growing is because of the sheer number of undiagnosed cases that go untreated annually. Both Color Lines and ProPublica report that according to the lead investigator, Dr. Carrie Gressler, who is currently researching this phenomenon, researchers in Atlanta interviewed more than 8,000 inner-city residents and found that about two-thirds said they had been violently attacked and that half knew someone who had been murdered. At least one in three of those interviewed experienced symptoms consistent with PTSD at some point in their lives, and that's a conservative estimate. She also said, and I quote, "The rates of PTSD we see are as high or higher than Iraq, Afghanistan, or Vietnam veterans. We have a whole population who is traumatized." The cause of the high proportion of PTSD in the neighborhoods like Chicago, Detroit, Atlanta, and Philadelphia is because of the high rate of violent crime where the residents of these neighborhoods have either witnessed or have been victimized by it. The result of undiagnosed PTSD is a deteriorating relationship with one's partner, repeated crime, and many social and economic consequences, i.e. job loss or sexual assault. When researchers at the Chicago Cook County Hospital started screening, it was proposed to spend about $200,000 a year to add staffers to screen all at-risk patients for PTSD and connect them with treatment. The taxpayer-subsidized hospital has an annual budget of roughly $450 million, but hospital administrators turned them down and suggested that they look for outside funding. Is it really too expensive to staff members to do something that they would otherwise do elsewhere? What valid reason is there to make something like healthcare, which is a human right, so unattainable and difficult to provide? But despite this institutional failure and disappointment, research and screening continues. Although it is a slow process, more attention is being given to the situation in terms of providing resources and added research to ensure assistance is given where it needs to be. However, this is a problem that should not have gone unnoticed based on one's socioeconomic status or race. Awareness is key in making sure that treatment to conditions like PTSD do not go unnoticed for so long. That in itself is a crime, considering resources are available. This goes to show that the government needs to be more accountable to its citizens, but one can only hope this will someday happen.
That was amazing, Mercedes. Thank you so much, Mercedes, for bringing that to light.
Without gloves.
A budget of $450 million, and they can't donate $200K. Crazy. You, for all our listeners out there, just to remind you, you're listening to a special edition of Spitfire Women of Color Radio. We're on CKUT 90.3 FM as part of the Homelessness Marathon. And
We're outside.
It's cold out here for a sister, y'all. I can barely talk. All right, we're on CKUT 90.3 FM as part of the Homelessness Marathon, a national broadcast that will be running until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. That's right, we'll be outside all night long. We're outside the Native Friendship Center in downtown Montreal. Call us toll-free, 1-866-594-7729. CKUT will be here all night holding it down for the homeless. Here now is an interview with Bridget Tolley.
Okay, we're here with Bridget Tolley. Bridget is the founder of Sisters in Spirit and Families of Sisters in Spirit. Bridget, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
So I wanted to just talk to you a little bit about your story. I know it's so powerful. You're a really amazing figure within the movement of justice for missing and murdered women. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about how you got into that movement and what that movement is.
Well, my mother was Gladys Tolley. She was struck and killed by the Quebec police in 2001. So I didn't really know anything about the missing and murdered women before that. And this is what got me into it, was looking for justice for my own mother, because she was struck and killed by the Quebec police. The brother of the cop that struck and killed my mother was in charge of the scene, and there was so many other stuff, things wrong in the case, like the address, the date, the time. There were so many jurisdiction issues, the police, just, you know, with all the police, three different police forces. There was so much stuff wrong with it. And this is when I start really looking into it and looking into all the other stuff. And along my journey, I found out that, you know, the government was trying to forget about my mom and all these other missing and murdered women. So this is how I started, you know. It was a journey for justice for my mother. Not only that, in 2008, there was actually two missing girls that went missing from my reserve. So that got me a little bit more involved in it. And you just want to try and help the family as much as you can when something like this happens, or other families. And this is why I started Families of Sisters in Spirit, is to give a voice to the families. I don't speak for families. Families, I want them to speak for themselves, you know. And they should be heard. They need to be heard. And this is what makes the stories, the voices powerful from families, you know. I just want justice, and this is what all the families want. We want to bring home our missing. We want to find our unsolved, the unsolved murders, and do it whatever we can to bring home these missing women, you know, as soon as, in the first few days, you know, if that's possible. So we do whatever we can to help families.
You know, Bridget, I remember when I was growing up, Elizabeth Smart from the southern United States was kidnapped, and it was headline news every single day. Find Elizabeth Smart, find Elizabeth Smart, find Elizabeth Smart. She was this little blonde white girl in, I think, Utah. And, you know, we know we have the Amber Alert now, and that comes out of sort of a similar story of a woman who was kidnapped. And I'm wondering, you know, why do you think that certain stories like these make such headline news and grab the, you know, national attention in such a way, and then other stories like woman after woman after woman, mainly indigenous, are just sort of, you know, flying under the radar or ignored, or the police aren't acting faster, or it's not in the news more?
Well, you know, it's because I feel that they feel that we're not important. You know, we're from the res, we're poor people, and it's always been like that. Even like in my mother's story, I go back to that because I know I can speak about that. And even in my mother's story, they don't talk about my mother as a beautiful grandmother of 18 grandchildren, you know. For me, they made it sound like my mother died because she was drunk and not because she got killed by the car. And why they do that, you know.
Wow.
It's been, for from, you know, stems from long time ago and everything that happened to us that, you know, we didn't ask for this, you know, we didn't ask to go to residential school, we didn't ask to be, you know, to do all this to us, to for the 60s group, taking the children away, placing them, you know, in non-native homes. Our parents didn't ask for that. And why they started doing that to us, I don't know. You know, they were trying to change us, obviously, to make us fit in this their world. You know, this wasn't our world, it was their world. There was so much violence from that, and, you know, it's still here today, and this is what we need to change, you know, we're just beautiful, we have beautiful people, there's, you know, we have lawyers, we have teachers, we have doctors, just like everybody else, you know, so this is why people have got to change, we're human beings, you know, and when our children go missing, you know, we want the same, the same as, you know, when a non-native girl goes missing, what's the difference with our girls and, you know, a non-native girl? And this is, you know, this is the real truth, you know, because even in 2008, when the two girls went missing on my reserve, Maisie Okick and Shannon Alexander, you know, we had a news conference. Nobody came. There was two media persons there. And then 2 years later, when a baby lion went missing named Boomer, you know, I love animals and everything, but when baby Boomer went missing, we had helicopters, we had police, we had game wardens, we had everything there. But when it came down to two missing people, nobody was there. So you tell me what's wrong here, what's wrong, because I don't get it, you know. And this is something that we have to, you know, I feel like we always have to do more, or even for the searches, we have to do our own search. But when something like this happens, or a non-native girl goes missing, or something, you know, they get all of this. But when our kids go missing, it just feels like it's so different. And, you know, the families have to do all the work themselves. Yeah. And this is why we try and support as much as we can, because I know it's hard. My daughter went missing for 5 days in October, and that was the hardest thing in my life. I didn't eat. I couldn't sleep. You know, you have so much things going through your mind. There was tips. You just want to run to where those tips are, where the girls are seen, you know, and stuff like this. So it's really hard emotionally. And, when something like this happens to a family, I'm very lucky my daughter came back to me. And but there's so many that aren't as lucky as me, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is why I continue to help, you know. I might never see the justice that I want or my mother so deserves, but if I can help another family not go through what I'm going through, you know, my heart feels good. Not only that, you know, like I said, the women from downtown Eastside Vancouver, how long are they marching now? For 23 years? Is that something I have to look forward to, you know? It's been 12 years for me. I can't imagine marching another 12 years to have to be 25 years for justice or something like this. You know, we shouldn't have to. We've already marched a couple of generations. How many more generations are we going to have to fight for this justice that our sisters so deserve?
Thank you so much, Bridget. I think you're absolutely right that it's clearly racism, and it's a kind of disregard that some people matter more than other people, and it's really disgusting. Bridget, I wanted to ask you also, you mentioned the downtown east side and some of the economic aspects of this. Do you think there are links between homeless women or women on the street and women who go missing and murdered? And, you know, if you think so, what are those links, or maybe not?
Well, you I really don't think there's links because, you know, it's not only them that are missing.
Yeah.
Again, I'll mention Loretta Sanders. Loretta Saunders. She's a student. She was going to St. Mary's. She was working on a thesis for the Justice for Missing and Murdered Women.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, it's not only the homeless or people working on the streets or people like that. It's anybody. I mean, you know, there's so many women. We have Daylene Bossy from Saskatchewan. She was going to be a teacher. She was going to school to be a teacher. You know?
Right.
So they're not only targeted, they're targeting any of our missing women, our women, you know?
Right.
So I don't feel like they're specifically targeting the homeless or them. It's all of us. I mean, it doesn't matter who you are. It's just as long as you're a Native woman, I guess, you're considered. And even look at my mother. I mean, you know, it's like she was a drunken Indian woman, and that was it, you know?
Right.
And this is what the police report said, oh, she died because she was drunk. She died because she was drunk. She died because she was drunk. You know, so this is it. This is what they put. This is the police. Another thing is, it's the police that are a big problem when it comes to missing and murdered women. You know, they weren't supposed to be there. They're supposed to be there to help us, to help, you know. And instead, you can see with the Human Rights Watch report, I mean, all the problems they're having in BC with the police. But this is not only in BC, this is happening all across Canada.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, it's happening everywhere to all of us, no matter who you are or what you're doing.
Right.
Or who you're with, you know, it doesn't matter.
It defies stereotype, but they keep trying to pigeonhole it into certain stereotypes.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I think even, you know, it's crazy. I almost feel like the police could be considered an accessory to these crimes by their negligence. Because certainly if I was someone who wanted to hurt women and, you know, didn't want to pay the consequences for that, I would absolutely target Native women because I know that the police never do anything when it's an Indigenous woman. So it's just disgusting.
Exactly. It makes it easier for them.
Bridget, I just want to ask you in these sort of final moments of the interview, thank you so much for your courage and just, I don't know how you keep going to just speak about this again and again and again. I guess that's what I want to ask is sort of what does keep you going? What are your dreams for the future? What do you hope for? And what can people listening out there do and how can they help?
Well, you know, I started this for one reason and it's always going to be that. I want justice. I want justice for my mother. I want justice for all our missing and murdered women.
Yeah.
That deserves this justice. And for the families, you know, them too. It's really hard for a family to keep going, especially, you know, knowing that the wrongs are there. All we want to do is try to fix those wrongs, you know, because if this happens again, if something happens like this on my reserve again, what are we going to do? Nobody knows what we're going to do. So is the family going to go through the same thing I'm going through our family? You know, so it's important that we try and fix this, but we need help. We can't do this alone. The government is involved. The federal government's involved. The provincial governments are involved. You know, so we need to work together to make sure that we honor those agreements, the police agreements, the resolutions, the treaties. These need to be honored and respected before we can even move forward. You know, like I said, if we just forget about all these wrongs and move forward, nothing is going to be fixed, and the same thing is going to happen over and over and over again. So this is what, you know, we got to help everybody. We want to be treated equally, first of all, and we want justice for our loved ones. And this is something that's not going to change. I've heard from families that have missing loved ones from 30 years ago, you know, and they're still looking and hoping for that, you know, that little piece of justice or something. And this is what gives me hope, because look at even just the downtown east side, 23 years of marching, wow, that's almost a quarter of a century, you know, of marching for justice. So, you know, when I feel, you know, things aren't going good, or I get, you know, depressed a little bit, I think of all them people or all the other families or even just the new families that need help, that, you know, that we can help. So if we're able to help somebody not go through the same thing we did, you know, that's a good sign for me.
Us too. We're going to continue to stand with you, Bridget. Spitfire Radio, CKUT 90.3. Our show is happy to be a platform for this issue. And we look forward to speaking with you again in the future. And just thank you so, so much for talking to us today.
Well, thank you for calling me, Malik. And it's an honor and a pleasure at any time to, if anybody wants to know anything, please feel free to call me and find us on. We have a Facebook group, Families Assisted in Spirit, and we also have a page. So, if anybody wants to contact us at familiesofsistersinspirit@gmail.com.
For our listeners, that contact information again is Families of Sisters in Spirit. Check them out on Facebook or familiesofsistersinspirit@gmail.com. And you can always get in touch with us at spitfire@ckut.ca for more information.
It's your land. This land is my land.
It's 6:32 and we are here in front of the Native Friendship Center. You are listening to a special edition of Spitfire Women of Color Radio 90.3 FM. Earlier that was Bridget Tolley of Families of Sisters in Spirit with Malek. Thank you, Malek, for that very powerful
piece. Thank you,
piece.
Malek.
And now, introducing a new Spitfire correspondent, Miguel. She will be dropping some wisdom on urban gentrification in Montreal.
Thanks, Mercedes. Now, it's been years since plans for a so-called revitalization of Cabot Square was announced. A patch of public space located in the Shaughnessy Village, a low-income neighborhood near Atwater Metro in the borough of Ville-Marie, Cabot Square has been a space for community organizing, including but not limited to the annual Sisters in Spirit Memorial and March and Vigil. However, Cabot Square is often depicted as a space teeming with homelessness, with a very small population of homeless immigrants paired with a predominantly large amount of homeless Aboriginal people congregating on the east side of the square. To a growing group of Aboriginals, the city represents an urban center where they can move in order to escape the hardships of their own communities, such as the loss of traditional livelihoods, poverty, environmental degradation, a shortage of water supplies, and domestic violence, according to the Montreal Urban Aboriginal Community Strategy Network. However, marginalized, stigmatized, and even pathologized, many Aboriginals are denied such opportunities. What seems to be the major concern of Ville-Marie residents and business owners is this outright visibility of homelessness, an exposure to alcohol and drug use, and the home and the uncleanliness of the square, which all makes it difficult to quote-unquote take back the space. A number of participants surveyed in the safety and well-being of Cabot Square in the period of March 26 to April 27, 2013, suggested that the removal and quarantining of the homeless population would improve the square. What this implies is the stratification between residents who own property and residents who don't, those whose identity is grounded in the legality of owning property, and those who are stripped of their identity because they do not.
The strategies to be implemented, therefore, neglect to use a holistic approach to the issue of homelessness itself, opting instead for superficial and economic enhancements. Plans to revitalize the square include a construction of condos in the area, a tool often relished in the process of gentrification. Of course, the creation of condos in the area would raise the cost of living in Shaughnessy Village, but this aligns perfectly with the city's three-pronged initiative to boost the economy, preserve heritage, and improve the quality of life in the area. But for whom? With the influx of rich families in the neighborhood due to condo construction, low-income residents will be displaced from their homes. Furthermore, the notion of homelessness as an unsightliness will be brought to the forefront of this by these wealthy proprietors. In a press release dated September 17, 2012, the SPVM Police Station 12 declared it would begin Operation Square, signaling an increased police presence and interventions to combat crime and incivilities that residents complained of. Most interactions between homeless individuals and the police result in arrests, fines, or the confiscation of paraphernalia, hindering the process of frontline workers, who note that the confiscation of materials allows for high-risk conduct such as sharing materials. With an over-dependence on law enforcement and imprisonment, chances to adopt and encourage appropriate services and programming for Aboriginal people are overlooked. In the three-year capital plan from 2012 to 2014, La Ville de Montréal cites $6 million in restoration fees as a means of, quote, maintaining and promoting our heritage. In a sense, this is the reconstitution of what Dr. Shireen Razak, professor of sociology and equity studies at the University of Oise, Toronto, calls a white settler society. It is an ongoing colonial project where the bodies of Aboriginal people, owing to their difference, owing to their assumed deviance from normative society, are relegated, displaced, and confined. If we look at the development as a reflection of this, we see that the revitalization is only a further articulation of colonial expansion, of re-establishing ownership over land by a white settler society, which relegates Aboriginal bodies to the fringes, away from sight. This displacement is in the same vein as that carried out by the Aboriginal Indian Act. Now let's look at the quote-unquote unsightliness of public drinking and drug use of Aboriginal homeless populations. Can we not see this substance abuse in Aboriginal communities as an instrument and direct result of colonization? Can the implementation of residential schools, the Indian Act, child welfare issues, Indian agents, geographic isolation, and racism not bear the blame? As Razak notes, these are, quote, bodies that bear the imprint of colonial power, end quote. These are the manifestations of a history of violence, a history of narratives silenced and quarantined. In vowing to eradicate the unsightliness of homeless individuals, the city is ensuring that this history is forgotten, shifting the blame from colonialism to the peoples affected by it. With Westmount, the predominantly white, affluent, Anglophone community sharing its border with the borough, and Alexis Neon Mall, as well as Concordia, in close proximity to the square, the imperatives of a capitalist mentality take the reins of the revitalization process. Homelessness bears no economic potential, no value, and therefore is deemed valueless. What results is a systemic erasure of Aboriginal bodies, rendering them invisible, no longer unsightly, no longer a reminder of a long-standing colonial legacy.
Woo-hoo!
Thank you, Gal. Congratulations on your first
amazing
meeting.
So cool.
This is bringing back
amazing
memories of my first Spitfire show, which was February of 2007. So it was, although we were inside. Congratulations.
Oh my God. Well done.
Okay. You're listening to Spitfire, broadcasting live from outside the Native Friendship Center on St. Laurent, downtown Montreal. My lips are freezing, so my apologies in advance if the words that I'm saying don't make sense.
Respect
tonight's
to
special programming on CKUT 90.3 FM is part of the Homelessness Marathon, a national broadcast that will be running until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Call us and show your support and solidarity with homeless people in our community and across the country. 866-594-7729. If you want to learn more about homelessness, call us toll-free. That's 866-594-7729. And now, in honor of Black History Month, I want to highlight the connections of Black Indigenous solidarity. In Leslie Silkel's novel, Almanac of the Dead, a foretelling of revolutionary decolonization, she connects the early resistance of Indigenous peoples and enslaved Africans to the current anti-colonial struggle, illuminating the anti-colonial possibilities of Afro-Indigenous or Afro-Digenous collective action. In the novel section entitled Africa, the novel's hella long, so there's like five sections, and this one's called Africa, Silkel highlights the historical phenomenon of Africans resisting slavery and joining with Indigenous peoples in rebellion through her portrayal of the fictional character Clinton, who is a Black Cherokee. Clinton's proud identification as a Black Indian breathes life into these obscured histories of Afro-Indigenous descendants and mixed communities of African and Indigenous peoples who work together against colonization, a threat to the survival of both peoples. The connective Afro-Indigenous experience that Clinton embraces underscores the ways in which the knowledge of a people's past resistance is a self-driving factor in their current emancipation. Throughout Silkel's narrative, Clinton remains convinced of the necessity of Black people, knowing how deeply African blood had watered the soil of the Americas. Silkel celebrates the collective resistance by Africans and Indigenous peoples, challenging the history's obscurity and sometimes erasure within colonial narratives. Revisiting this history in the novel presents an important opportunity to consider the historical importance of the abounding examples of African and Indigenous people who were united in struggle and shared cultural practices. Indigenous communities were active in helping New World Africans escape slavery and remain out of captivity through incorporation into their communities. In 18th century southern Florida, for instance, the Black Seminoles emerged from within escaped members of the Creek Nation who welcomed other Indigenous groups and escaped African slaves into their communities. Black Seminoles introduced rice cultivation methods from Senegambia and Sierra Leone to Florida Seminole communities and fought collectively with Seminole Africans on Florida plantations and neighboring Maroon settlements in the first and second Seminole Wars against U.S. slave raider efforts. In Canada, closer to home, the Rotinosoni of the Six Nations adopted runaway slaves into their clans and communities. The Rotinosoni ran an underground railway where Tuscarora guides helped slaves reach their communities safely, and when such actions could have resulted in their own enslavement, murder, or removal from their land. Maroon communities throughout the Americas. Maroon communities are communities of escaped slaves who subsisted independently, often joined with Indigenous peoples and created settlements removed from plantation oppression. Maroon descendants to this day still reside in places such as Cuba, Puerto Rico, Trinidad and Tobago, representing Mercedes, reestablishing Afro-Indigenous shared communities and struggle through discussing early resistors. Enables Leslie Silkel to map the history of the Americas along a 500-year path of sustained opposition to the violence of European colonization. Right now, I'm going to try to read, if my lips don't freeze, an excerpt from Leslie Silkel's novel, which was first published in 1991. This excerpt, as I said, comes from the section entitled Africa. Leslie Silkel is a writer and member of the Laguna Pueblo tribe, which is based in western New Mexico. The section I'm going to read is the beginning of Clinton's broadcast of foretelling revolutionary change. It's called Spirit Power.
Ow!
Okay. The book is really heavy, so let me just try. Clinton's first broadcast in the reborn United States was going to be dedicated to the children born to escape slaves who married Carib Indian survivors. The first broadcast would be dedicated to them, the first African Native Americans. Clinton talked about the tapes he was making for radio stations, but he never let Roy hear any of them. Clinton said he could describe all the tapes, and Roy would have a better idea if he just let Clinton talk. Roy had seen the box full of newspaper clippings, The one on the top was about African woman who was leading an army of rebels somewhere in Africa. The headline had called the woman a voodoo priestess. Clinton said the African woman was only 27, but her troops loved her like children and called her Mama Mary. Mama Mary and her troops had raised hell with government troops. The ordinary people, the citizens in Africa, had the same problems with government politicians as the people had in the United States. The people worked day and night to pay taxes, but still found themselves hungry and homeless. The voodoo priestess and her soldiers believed that with her power, sticks and stones would explode like grenades and bees would become bullets. Mama Mary had rubbed the chests of her young soldiers with special oils to stop bullets. Now here was the kind of army to have the kind of voodoo woman had had in Africa, because Clinton had seen years ago in Vietnam that the little jungle people weren't just good fighters. They used all kinds of poisons and spells and prayers to spirits to attack the GIs in Vietnam. You should know, Clinton said to Roy. You must have seen that stuff. Little monkey gods on altars, things like that. That was Clinton's latest theory. The U.S. military had lost the Vietnam War because the Viet Cong had used magic and spirits. How else had they lost? They had had superior firepower. They had bombed every square foot of the entire country, and still the U.S. had lost. Clinton wasn't saying the spirits had done it all. Or spirits had even done half of it, but the spirits had tipped the scale in the Vietnamese favor. Roy did not bother to argue with Clinton about ghosts winning the Vietnam War. Clinton might be right. Roy had felt like a ghost himself since the war. When he saw, Roy wasn't going to argue. Clinton admitted he didn't totally believe in that kind of superstitious stuff. He was convinced magic oil could stop bullets. Clinton still believed in the M16. Don't worry. He had seen saturation bombing by B-52s. He'd seen how napalm burned like a laser through flesh and bone. I just mean that kind of spirit stuff helps, Clinton said. Like God is on our side, that kind of stuff, Roy said. He smiled so Clinton wouldn't accuse him of being an a-hole. Clinton believed it was the other a-hole. Clinton believed it was important for the people to understand that all around them lay human slavery, although most of it had been called by other names. Sorry, my hands are freezing. My hands are freezing, and so is the book. I'm trying to turn the page. Someone please help me. I can't turn the page.
I don't think they're... Oh, whoa.
Okay, in the interest of time, I think we're going to just skip ahead. Also, because Alyssa's hands are not able to hold the book anymore because they're so cold. So, I'm just going to skip ahead a few paragraphs. Roy pointed out that people might not want someone burning candles and spilling rum because it might cause a fire. Typical white man thinking. Clinton had learned to expect that even the best of them, such as Roy, sometimes just didn't see. Candles, rum, and incense didn't necessarily mean a fire. The white man should stop everything before it started. The white man would pretend to know that all the answers ahead of time, but of course, really, the white man didn't have a clue. The white man had made some monumental errors in the 500 years Europeans had disrupted Africa, China, and the Americas. The Chinese and Africans had broken free now. Now it was only a matter of time before all captive people on Earth would rise up. Clinton talked to the blade when he poured the rum over it. The cutting metal edge of the knife was an Ugu's favorite dwelling. In Africa, metal workers were Ugu's priests. Clinton's people all revered the knife. Clinton offered this prayer. This is a prayer by Clinton. Ugu, warrior and metal maker. Ugu wages war every day. Ugu, we suffer a great deal in this battle with our oppressors. Ugu protects those who serve him. Ugu is watchful. Ugu has a boundless energy. Ugu is powered by anger. Ugu foray, you magnet power. Pull iron fragments together. Gather the lost to your chest. Ugu, your father, love, heals them. All the scattered fragments. Ancestor spirits gathered. Ugu Ferre, you lead them to war for the sake of us, their descendants. Ugu Ferre, commander of the Army of the Lost, is found. Ugu fires the cannon to announce the uprising. Rage, blind rage, destroys all in reach. Mad Dog Warrior. The shrine had made people, even other blacks, afraid because America had swallowed all that Hollywood bullshit BS about voodoo and the devil. Some guys were even objected to the apples Clinton left out for the spirits. Clinton did not blame people for their ignorance, but at some point a man had to teach himself or learn something. He explained the apples had to be left to rot so the ancestor spirits could eat them. So that was an excerpt from Leslie Silko's book, Almanac of the Dead. I apologize for the delay. My hands had slightly frozen there.
Good job.
Well done, Alyssa. Want to read that book.
Thanks, Alyssa. We're going to go to some tunes now and then come back to say goodbye.
From California.
That brings us to the end of the show. We thank everyone who made this show possible. A big shout out to the CKUT Homelessness Marathon organizers. Woo!
Don't forget about tomorrow's picket in front of the Montreal Immigration Offices, 1010 Saint Antoine. We'll be there from noon to 1 p.m. in solidarity with Madame Awan, who has been in sanctuary in Montreal, in a Montreal church, for the past 6 months to resist deportation.
Tonight's special Spitfire programming on CKUT 90.3 FM is part of the Homelessness Marathon, a national broadcast that will be running until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. So call in and show your solidarity with homelessness people in our community and, you know, just like everywhere on planet Earth. So toll-free number is 866-594-7729. Questions? Want to learn more about homelessness? Call us 1-866-594-7729.
Thank you so much for staying with us. I could tell you we've been out here for an hour and we're all dying. So mad respect to anybody who makes these Montreal streets their home. We know it's not easy. Mad respect. Spitfire Women of Color Radio broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM. You can write to us at Spitfire. Let me break this down for y'all. It's not fire, it's fire. That's F-I-Y-A-H. Spitfire at CKUT.ca. And check us out on www.spitfire@blogspot.com. And also follow us on Twitter at Spitfire Radio. Peace, y'all.
Woo!
Woo!
Bye,
guys. Bring us America.
Get your money dollar bill, y'all. To my folks on the picket line, don't stop.